from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Charles Ferguson won an Oscar for Inside Job, his blistering tough 2010 documentary on the financial crisis, he pulled no punches, even in his acceptance speech at the Academy Awards.
I must start by pointing out that 3 years after a horrific financial crisis caused by massive fraud, not a single financial executive has gone to jail, and that's wrong.
Charles Ferguson is still mad, and he thinks the whole country should be and would be if it really understood what's going on in finance, in our politics, in our economy. This hour on Point, Inside Jobs, Charles Ferguson on America at risk of third world style rich versus poor decline. You can join the conversation. Did Inside Job light your fire? Are we on top of the problem, still underneath it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined by Charles Ferguson in just a moment, but first, just for a minute, the latest on Washington's endless debate on regulation and finance. There were more hearings yesterday in the Senate Banking Committee. Here's Committee Chairman Tim Johnson, Democratic Senator from South Dakota, calling the J.P. Morgan Chase loss that we learned about last week a wake-up call.
I want to make a few comments about the recent news made by J.P. Morgan Chase. The company's massive trading loss is a stark reminder of the financial crisis of 2008 and the necessity of Wall Street reform.
The necessity of Wall Street reform, but we haven't really seen it yet. Ben Protes is legal and regulatory reporter for the New York Times. Ben, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what was the main point yesterday? Are they driving forward with reforms? Are they just beating up on J.P. Morgan Chase? What was the agenda?
The agenda is to figure out what exactly happened at J.P. Morgan and then to kind of see what implications there would be down the road for Wall Street regulation. And I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I think some on the Republican side want to learn a little bit more, and some on the Democratic side are really using this as a talking point to push for tougher regulation.
Is there something to be learned from this recent two, now maybe three, maybe $4 billion, I don't know what it is, but billion-dollar loss that we didn't know before, Ben?
Well, I think what we thought before is that this unit that generated the loss was just hedging, was just doing things that were safe and were just mitigating risk elsewhere in the business. And what we learned is that sometimes, you know, what Wall Street says it's doing with a particular business, once again, is not always true. And in fact, this hedge actually became much like a proprietary bet. And I think that has major implications for policy that would rein in such kind of trading.
Well, what about that? You know, the debate over the details of Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Rule has gone on and on. Did you hear material advances in considering what ought to be done with those in these hearings?
I think that we're starting to see that there will be implications for the Volcker Rule. I think, you know, if you see the Volcker Rule is banning these kinds of trades, you know, proprietary trading specifically at big banks, then I think this is case in point what the reformers and what the liberal lawmakers are using as an example of why we need a strong Volcker Rule. And, you know, I think people inside the regulatory agencies are not quite sure how they're going to use this to their advantage. But I think that the tide has turned against Wall Street and in the favor of tougher regulation. And I think the hearing yesterday kind of was one data point in that.
Has J.P. Morgan been chastened by this? J.P. Diamond or anybody else who may have shown up there yesterday? Are they on board now with reform, or do you still see the lobbyists turned out against it?
Well, the lobbyists are still turning out against it, and I think that there's, you know, broadly on Wall Street, it's not just J.P. Morgan, though they've been among the most aggressive. I think that, you know, even J.P. Morgan itself has said in the past, Jamie Dimon has said in the past, that they support elements of the Volcker Rule, but they want a strong exemption for hedging. The question is, what is hedging, right? I mean, this trade initially appeared to be a hedge, and then it kind of went awry and became a proprietary bet. So I think that they're still very forceful. All the trade groups and the Chamber of Commerce and all these groups are really pushing hard still on the Volcker Rule and broadly on the Dodd-Frank reforms. And so, you know, while yes, they are slightly chastened by this as the firm itself, there's still a strong pushback on this stuff.
And what's the timetable now? It's been years. Is there a timetable for when we'll know if these strong regulation will live or die or just squeak away?
Right now we're in crunch time. The next 6 months is what's crucial here. So Dodd-Frank is, you know, if you think about Dodd-Frank, is about 400 rules. About a quarter of them have been finalized. Most of them were already supposed to be finalized last summer, but all the deadlines have been passed. So I think the next 6 months are what's crucial here. And especially on Volcker, I think that the noises we've been hearing is that, you know, that they're hoping to get a draft done by August or September. Obviously, you know, this J.P. Morgan thing throws a bit of a wrench in that. And so it's not clear how the exact impact will be, but I think that they really want these things done by fall before the election, because if you have a different makeup in Congress, potentially in the White House, it's a whole different game.
Ben Protest, legal and regulatory correspondent for The New York Times. Ben, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Charles Ferguson's Oscar-winning documentary Inside Job described the financial crisis and its causes through a series of interviews with experts and policymakers, many of whom were involved firsthand. Here's a section from the film's trailer.
So did these guys know that they were doing something dangerous?
I think they did.
I don't hear confessions.
What can we believe in? There's nothing we can trust anymore.
We had a whole group of people looking at this for
Excuse
whatever reason.
You can't be serious. If you would have looked, you would have found things.
It's a Wall Street government.
Why do you think there isn't a more systematic investigation being undertaken?
Because then you'll find the culprits.
From the inside, from Inside Job, director Charles Ferguson joins us now from New York. Director, writer, and producer of the Academy Award-winning documentary. His new book is Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Charles Ferguson, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
You made a heck of a film. It really opened a lot of people's eyes, put things in clear terms that people could really grab onto and understand. What's the message that you're bringing in your book, Predator Nation?
Well, two things, I think. The first is that several years after the crisis, we now have a substantial, still inadequate and very limited, but a substantial evidentiary record from government investigations and private lawsuits. And we now know that there was a great deal of criminality that was involved in causing this crisis, which has gone unpunished. And the second point that I make in the book is that this is part of a larger pattern in America of money-based politics having a role in many of America's most serious economic problems.
You put that larger pattern in very, very stark terms. They're arresting, and not many people articulate it quite so bluntly. I wish, Charles, if you'd be good enough, you'd read just a bit for us from the book where you kind of lay out this big sweep, what you see as having gone on in the last couple, three decades here. Could you do that?
Yes. Starting around 1980, American society began to undergo a series of deep shifts. Deregulation, weakened antitrust enforcement, technological changes led to increasing concentration of industry and finance. Money began to play a larger and more corrupting role in politics. America fell behind other nations in education, in infrastructure, and in the performance of many of its major industries. Inequality increased. As a result of these and other changes, America is turning into a rigged game, a society that denies opportunity to those who are not born into wealthy families, one that resembles a third world dictatorship more than an advanced democracy. The Occupy Wall Street protests that began in New York in September 2011 and then rapidly spread around America and the world were initially somewhat unclear in their goals, but the protesters were deeply right about one thing. Over the last 30 years, the United States has been taken over by an immoral financial oligarchy, and the American dream of opportunity, education, and upward mobility is now largely confined to the top few percent of the population. Federal policy is increasingly dictated by the wealthy, by the financial sector, and by powerful, although sometimes badly mismanaged, industries such as telecommunications, healthcare, automobiles, and energy. These policies are implemented and praised by these groups' willing servants, namely the increasingly bought and paid for leadership of America's political parties, academia, and lobbying industry. If allowed to continue, this process will turn the United States into a declining, unfair society with an impoverished, angry, uneducated population under the control of a small, ultra-wealthy elite. Such a society would not only be immoral, but also eventually unstable, dangerously ripe for religious and political extremism.
It's Charles Ferguson, director, writer of Inside Job, reading from his new book, Predator Nation, Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. That's about as sweeping as you can get. I mean, it sounds, as you read it there in that kind of calm voice, Charles, it sounds sort of like a sci-fi horror film plot being laid out. You're saying this is it. This is our country.
Well, it could be. It's we're going in that direction. I'm concerned about America's future. America's had problems before, has had very serious problems before, and has recovered from them, and I hope that happens again. But it's a very worrisome direction.
Turning into something that resembles more a third-world dictatorship than an advanced democracy? Evidence?
Well, actually, you know, if you drive around America and then compare it to, say, Northern Europe or in some ways even countries like Korea or Taiwan, this country is poor and now for the first time in American history, on average, Americans will do less well than their parents and have less education than their parents.
Do you think Americans understand what's been going, what is going on?
I think many of them do. Maybe not in the details, but I think that there's a very widely shared sense that America has become much more unfair and that our political system is failing us. I think that particularly among America's younger generation, I think there's a widely shared sense of kind of cynicism and fatalism about American politics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the bare-knuckled critic of American finance and politics today, Charles Ferguson, director of the Academy Award-winning film Inside Job, author of the new book Predator Nation, Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and Charles Ferguson joins us from New York. Charles, you've made a big impression on a lot of people, but I think many people don't really know your own background. I mean, it's not as if you came straight out of like a world of growing up protesting. There may have been plenty of that there too, but you were an entrepreneur. You made a ton of money. You built a tech company and sold it to Microsoft back in the 90s.
Yes, that's true. I'm not an anti-business person. I think that business and a free market economy are wonderful, important, good things. I just think that people should make their money honestly and without destroying the economy. And unfortunately, the financial sector has not been doing that recently.
You're right. In The Predator Nation, you say, I'm not against business or profits or becoming wealthy. I have no problem with people becoming billionaires. But then you cite examples of people who do that who you applaud and others who you don't. Give us sort of the two sides of the street there.
Well, I think that a lot of America's high technology sector is a good example of good ways to make a lot of money that are beneficial to a lot of people. And I know some of these people personally, and indeed a few of them became very good friends, and some still are.
I mean, you're looking at Steve Jobs at Apple or, you know, the founders of Google or eBay or Craigslist or Amazon or Genentech or Warren Buffett for that matter. And you remind us of a time where with Intel, for example, you describe all the things that it's done to make the economy work in pretty dazzling ways. But the time when one of the founders, Robert Noyce, was actually personally inventing new technology, the integrated circuit, no less. And you're contrasting that with what, Charles?
Well, with what financial services has become, which is a way basically to take a cut from the American economy and appropriate it, often by doing things that are not only unethical but financially and economically destabilizing and destructive.
How did this happen?
That's a very good question. Slowly and fast. This does have its roots in technological and political changes that started several decades ago. And gradually, American financial services became very concentrated, and it also became essentially unregulated. And as it became wealthier, it became more politically powerful, which enabled it to become yet wealthier, which enabled it to become yet more politically powerful. And we woke up one day
in 2008 to find out that it had become so powerful that it could cause a major financial and economic crisis through, in many cases, criminal behavior and get away with it.
So when you describe, and we just heard you say it this, over the last 30 years, you say the United States has been taken over by an amoral financial oligarchy. What's the machinery of that takeover, that rule as you see it?
Well, the biggest single element of it is money and politics. In the book, I give numbers, for example, about what it used to cost to run a presidential campaign as opposed to what it costs now. The cost of running for president, and the same is true of running for the Senate or the House of Representatives, the cost of running a campaign has gone up by about a factor of 20 over the last 30 years. And that's now an immense amount of money. It's every election cycle. This is now many billions of dollars. And when you add to that the lobbying industry and the revolving door between government regulators and government service on the one hand and the private sector and the lobbying sector on the other, you get a very, very dangerous combination.
In Predator Nation, you describe that political firepower as being put to work to create and sustain what you call a canopy economy. What's that, canopy economy?
It's an economy where basically the people at the top get all the sunlight and the people at the bottom have to struggle in the dark. And so, in fact, what you find now is that the upper 1%, in fact, it's even more extreme than that, the upper 0.1% of the American economy does very, very, very well. And most Americans are experiencing mostly gradual but sometimes very catastrophic declines in their income.
But doesn't accepting that model, let's say that, and we've seen what's happened with income distribution, and you write about how skewed American income distribution is compared to any other industrial country, even the UK, doesn't that the sort of a top tier point, whatever, 0.01% that lives in the canopy, don't they depend on a strong, vibrant country underneath? Don't they still have an interest in keeping the broader nation vital?
Less and less, unfortunately. That's another major change over the last 30, 40 years. It used to be that American companies and their executives, of course, depended primarily on the American market and therefore on American consumers and American workers. That's no longer true. Now, most large companies in the United States derive a majority of their profits from overseas. And they also have a majority of their workers and get a majority of their components from overseas. And so they are less and less invested in the welfare of the broad American population. What they care about is, again, the upper few percent.
So what does that mean? If again, accepting your view that that's their only or their overwhelming interest, what does that mean in terms of policy? What would they be lobbying for and against?
Well, they lobby, of course, for free trade, and they lobby for deregulation, and they lobby for the right to operate globally, and they lobby, of course, for tax relief.
And roads, schools, education, I don't know, healthcare, the rest, how do those interests intersect with these?
They're no longer terribly important, unfortunately. And that's reflected in what's happened to American infrastructure and federal support for science and research and development and so on.
You know, we've been
this and the educational system, which is perhaps the single most important component of this.
This country's been so wealthy for so long that this is a hard sort of description to get one's head around. You've got your PhD in political science, and you've got your business background, but you're also a dramatist. I mean, in Inside Job, you expose and document it, also dramatize this. When you say the U.S. is headed toward a third world style society, is that for dramatic effect or do you literally mean it?
Well, no, I do, unfortunately, literally mean it. It won't happen overnight. This has been gradually happening for 30 years and it will take another several decades for this process to run to completion. If it does, I hope it doesn't. And I'm optimistic that it won't. I'm optimistic that America at some point will wake up and self-correct as it has done in the past. But the trend is very, very alarming, and we've already gone a rather scary distance along it. You know, many Americans who might not travel very much, for example, especially in Asia, might not understand that already the United States is far behind many Asian nations in broadband infrastructure, internet infrastructure.
Let's talk about hopes for change. Forgive me if I play another clip from your film, Inside Job. This is narrated by Matt Damon. There was the suggestion, the hope, that President Barack Obama would change things, and in the film, an assertion that, well, he didn't.
When the financial crisis struck just before the 2008 election, Barack Obama pointed to Wall Street greed and regulatory failures as examples of the need for change in America.
A lack of oversight in Washington and on Wall Street is exactly what got us into this mess.
After taking office, Obama spoke of the need to reform the financial industry.
We want a systemic risk regulator, increased capital requirements. We need a consumer financial protection agency. We need to change Wall Street's culture.
But in its first year, the Obama administration did not enact a single major financial reform.
That, Matt Damon from Charles Ferguson's Inside Job. Charles Ferguson joins us from New York City. His new book is Predator Nation. All right, Charles, it's now nearly 4 years since President Obama's election. Reform?
Not much, unfortunately. Very big, complicated law, Dodd-Frank. A lot of fighting and wrangling over its regulations, as your New York Times guest mentioned a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And not much in the way of really serious reform, and zero, literally zero, criminal prosecutions of major financial firms or senior executives.
You're pretty cynical about the two-party system. You call it a duopoly. We're in a big election year. A lot of Americans are taking it seriously. But you've got a very heavy critique for both parties here.
Yes, unfortunately. There still are differences between the parties and between the candidates, of course. It's not as if they're identical, but they do cooperate and depend upon the financial system and the system of money-based politics to a very, very dangerous extent.
To the extent that you, I mean, are you voting?
Yes.
Do you think that these parties will create a change?
Unfortunately not. On balance, I think that President Obama is, by a substantial margin, actually the better choice. He has tried to do a few limited things, but it's very, very far short of what we need.
But you describe a kind of kabuki theater where, you know, each side gets its base riled up over issues, then turns around and does just what your oligarchy, ruling oligarchy as you have it, wants.
In regard to regulation of major industries, yes, I think that's absolutely the case. The two parties and their leaders fight brutally, viciously, angrily about all kinds of things, ranging from the debt ceiling to gay marriage to, you know, contraception to all sorts of so-called values issues, gun control, many others. But when it comes to money and politics and the regulation of dangerous industries, especially financial services, unfortunately, they behave rather similarly.
But it's really not only there. I mean, you describe right across the waterfront things that aren't getting done in this country that need doing, that lots of people can see, and you suggest they're not getting done in part because the money bags don't really have an interest in it anymore.
Yes, unfortunately, this phenomenon of the globalization of American industry and therefore its lessening interest in the long-term health of the American people it is a very real phenomenon, unfortunately. And the American people, you know, they aren't terribly they're not organized in the way that the financial services industry is.
Charles Ferguson is with us, director of Inside Job. His new book is Predator Nation. We're going to look at criminality. He says there should still be charges. We're going to look at academics. He says you've got an awful lot of academics kind of in cahoots with a very skinny little ruling crowd. Lots of callers for you, Charles. Let's go to Vermont. Pulteney, Vermont, Fernando's calling. Fernando, you're on with Charles Ferguson.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you see?
Well, I want to thank Charles for his work. I have no end in sight, in addition to Inside Job, that I've watched many, many times. Fantastic work. I don't think it goes far enough, but I do appreciate the work Charles has done. And I would like to see Charles at least criticize capitalism a little bit. It's not the, you know, you call it the free market, it's capitalism. Let's use the capitalist word for capitalism.
Charles, what do you say? Criticize capitalism. Come on.
No, I have to say that I must respectfully disagree with your caller. I actually think capitalism is just fine if it's properly regulated. You know, I think that many of America's high technology companies are actually models for the kind of economy we ought to have and the way business should conduct itself. But business needs to be regulated, especially businesses that can cause systemic financial and economic crises.
And that's all it takes. Let's regulate and what? Get back to the sort of pre-80s model that worked for this country? You've got an awful lot of people who say, no, the world has changed. We need more sophisticated finance. We need more global companies. We can't go back.
Well, we do need sophisticated finance and we do need global companies, but they should still be regulated. And the crisis of 2008, I think, proved that point rather clearly.
Joseph in North Augusta, South Carolina. Joseph, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm listening to the newscast, and I'm very much interested in his approach. And my comment is this. First of all, I don't think our people in Congress are smart enough to regulate the finance industry, because I think they are smarter than the people in Congress. Second of all, they also don't want to bite the hand to feed them. They have a lot of lobbyists contributing to their political endeavors, and I think that's a detriment to getting the job done. That's my own comment that I have.
I appreciate that, Joseph. Charles, they're outsmarted by Wall Street, and they're kind of on the payroll. What hope?
There are some very intelligent people in Congress, and there are obviously some bankers who weren't terribly smart, given what we saw of their behavior over the last 10 years. So I'm not sure that I totally subscribe to that view in general. But I would say that there is an issue related to what the caller mentioned. Over the last 20 years, another part of this whole phenomenon has been that public sector salaries have declined sharply relative to private sector salaries. It used to be that if you were, for example, a federal prosecutor, of course you made less than a defense lawyer in private practice, but the gap wasn't gigantic. Mm-hmm. The gap has become gigantic. Now, the private sector and, of course, the lobbying industry, incomes are just so stratospherically dramatically higher than they are in public service that it's now difficult to get people to see public service and government service as a long-term career.
But that's always the third world-style problem, isn't it? I mean, you get these huge differences in wealth and suddenly public service becomes unattractive and you get this real lopsided society where it's all going up there. Who's going to do it for what begins to look like peanuts?
Alas, yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Charles Ferguson, director, writer, producer of the Academy Award-winning documentary Inside Job on the 2008 collapse and all that was behind it. He's out with a new book now called Predator Nation, with some very big warnings for the American people about where the country has come and where it's headed. Third world style, big, tall, rich sector, and skinny little poor sector and power distributed just that way. Predator Nation, Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America is the book. There's an excerpt at our website. He joins us from New York. Lots of response to you, Charles, online. Susie writes, thanks for inviting a guest who sees things clearly, speaks the truth, and doesn't insult the public with propaganda. Greg says, please explain why American voters allowed this to happen. And Drew in Georgia wants to hear solutions. We'll get to that, but what about the why? Why did this happen?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think it's difficult to overestimate the role now played by money in politics and the way that that has changed the nature of American politics over the last 30 years. That's one thing. The second thing is this division in America over values and culture issues has really gotten in the way of what I think are much more important issues for the long-term health and welfare of the American people and America as a nation. I think that people who are divided over questions like gay marriage should in many cases be united in calling for a change in the way America is run economically, educationally.
You're saying education system, workforce skills, healthcare, energy policies, infrastructure, like take care of business, America.
Yes.
And still, it's kind of incredible that it's been allowed. One thing you point to is criminality. We'll look at that. Tom in Tullahoma, Tennessee. You're on the air with Charles Ferguson, Tom.
Hi, Tom. I totally agree with everything this man is saying. I think I could have written the same book. I've seen this problem I was a mortgage broker in California and saw the underwriting standards just totally go away. And then I got into the meats industry, and the meats industry totally dominates policy. And they can't do anything about it in Congress because there's too many people that are just paid off and will stop, too many congressmen that are paid off and will just stop anything that has to do with any type of progress.
So what's your suggestion, Tom?
Well, there'd be less voter apathy if we could vote them either vote for them or vote for them to go to jail. There'd be a lot less voter apathy. The problem is when we have these criminals, when we have these crooks, when we have these things that go so wrong, we are not holding them accountable, but we'll hold a black man that holds up a gas station, we'll hold him accountable to the nth degree. And these billions and billions in frauds just goes unanswered as far as accountability. We have to hold people that are in the elite as accountable as anybody else under the law, or we don't really have a nation of laws anymore.
$100 robbery and you're off to prison for a long time, $100 billion, and it's a different story. Charles Ferguson, what about it? You got a long list here of things that you say, crimes that were committed and are prosecutable, securities fraud, accounting fraud, bribery, perjury, right on down. And yet, as you point out and others, it simply hasn't happened.
That is unfortunately true, yeah. And I think that part of the solution to these problems has to be a reinforcement of the political independence of the law enforcement system, the Justice Department, the FBI, other portions of the law enforcement system, particularly with regard to white-collar crime.
But where is your finger pointed? You say, j'accuse, I accuse, who, what?
Well, in the book, I go through a long list naming many names and describing many specific actions of people and institutions who committed prosecutable crimes and who haven't been prosecuted. So that list, it's a very long list, unfortunately. And these are, real crimes. These are not, minor technical infractions. These are really very serious things that contributed in a significant way to the bubble and the 2008 crisis.
So if you were Attorney General, how many would be on your let's go list? And what about the argument? We've heard it again and again. These were really bad mistakes, but they weren't crimes, we've heard from the Obama administration.
Well, they were crimes, and as I say, I go through that list in the book. There's no question in my mind that hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of senior financial executives should be prosecuted and should go to prison. And if that seems extravagant, then people should remember that in the wake of the first of the financial crises caused by financial deregulation, the SNL bubble and crisis of the 1980s, in the wake of the SNL crisis, several thousand financial executives were prosecuted and several hundred of them were sent to prison. And that crisis was minor compared to this one.
James in Waynesboro, Virginia. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, thank you so much for allowing me to call in. First of all, I love this program. But I also am overwhelmed by Charles Ferguson's work. I think it's probably the most meaningful and concise instrument that has brought to bear upon the travesty of 08 and the time leading up to it. My question is, I was an Obama supporter, still am, although I'm very disappointed in his lackluster performance in actually fulfilling his promise to reform Wall Street as well as the banking system. And I think it is the one unglamorous part of his program that he did not see through and still does not see through. It seems to me that the people at the bottom of the ladder are those that are most affected and who are also the most disconnected. The people at the top are very interested, and therefore they stay in touch with everything that is necessary. What I want to know is, I'd love to know why Obama has not fulfilled his promise and actually carried forward the criminal prosecutions that should have been. I'm an attorney. But that would certainly bring public attention to the extent of the malady that we confront.
James, let us pick it up right there, if we may, and I appreciate your call. Charles, bring your focus in tight on this question. Here's President Obama with public commitments. We heard him from your film on the record saying, we need to go after this. We will go after this. Now you and James saying it hasn't happened. Many can see it. Get tighter on why not.
It's a very good question. I wish I could be President Obama's psychotherapist and get inside his head. You know, of course, I don't know what's been going on inside his head. One can suppose several things. When he was elected, he had very little business, financial, economic expertise and experience. He'd never held a real private sector job. His training was in law. So he was, to a large extent, then at the mercy of his advisors. And the people that he chose as his advisors, his cabinet, senior government officials, turned out to be people who were deeply implicated in having contributed to the crisis and to the deregulation that led to the crisis. And so those people weren't going to go back on their own beliefs, their own actions. They weren't going to offend the powerful and wealthy people around them. And so we certainly saw in that pattern of appointments a major failure. Then there's President Obama's own personal political calculations. He may well have decided that it simply wasn't feasible to and wasn't in his own personal political interest to try and take on this problem in this very, very powerful, wealthy industry.
But that point is so interesting in itself because here's a smart guy, whatever you think of President Obama, he's a smart guy, and he hasn't been too bad in reading the American Political Pulse. And if that's a political calculation, does that suggest that he doesn't believe that Americans can hear and grab on, can or would hear and grab onto this critique and run with it to the polls? Somehow, you know, he doesn't believe if he raised the alarm sky high and just painted it in the starkest letters up there, as a president can do, he doesn't believe that Americans would respond. I mean, this is, should be of interest to you, right? You're writing about all this in the hope that people will read and take it on board and do something with it. Maybe President Obama doesn't believe they can or will.
Well, it's a very interesting and I think a very deep question about whether he actually could have gotten the American people behind him in a really powerful way when he was elected. I would like to think that it was possible. The country was in deep crisis. Unemployment was growing by 0.5% per month. The stability of the financial system was still in question. He had overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress. He had just been elected with an overwhelming mandate. I would like to think that it would have been possible then to get out front on this and really get something done. Now, of course, it's much harder. And now America's divisions over cultural and values issues have reasserted themselves, and his majority in Congress has evaporated. And, of course, we've had 4 years of his not doing anything. So now the political calculation is very difficult, and many people fear that it might take another major crisis before we have another political opportunity.
Speak to when the president has taken steps. He's been in no small quarters, quickly labeled in partisan quarters, labeled a socialist. That seems ironic. You're describing an oligopoly, right? A sort of rule by the rich, and the president sort of inching toward a reality that was mainstream in America for most of the 20th century and gets tagged a socialist. How does that work in political calculus?
I have to say that I do find it disappointing and actually mystifying to a certain extent. Many Americans seem to have forgotten our own history, even our own relatively recent history. I think that part of this is that many Americans are now nervous, tense, fearful, insecure about their economic and financial condition. And when people are tense and insecure, they are sometimes susceptible to demagoguery and simple solutions. That's part of it, I think. And part of it, I think, is a generational question. I think that American young people have a very different and much more cynical attitude towards their political leaders.
You point a pretty condemning figure at big chunks of academia. What's going on there in your view?
Well, in parallel with the rise of money in politics has been the rise of money in academia. The same American industries that began to throw sharply increasing amounts of money at the political system also began to hire leading academic economists and also professors of law and business and public policy as consultants, put them on advisory boards, put them on their boards of directors. And now these days, if you see a prominent economist testifying in Congress or appearing in the media or writing an article, writing an op-ed piece in the New York Times, whatever, there's a very high probability that that person is being very well paid by somebody who has a big stake in the question.
And they're handing us conceptual framework. Charles Ferguson, take us through your bullet points for what should be done. Just drive right down through those if you'd be good enough. You've got half a dozen things. They're all enormous. It's kind of overwhelming. On the other hand, you say, you know, this is what we've always taken care of in this country. Let's take care of it again. Could you do that for
us? Yes. Well, I think probably the two most important and fundamental things are we have to fix our educational system and we have to fix the problem of money in politics. Those are both incredibly difficult things to do. The people who now benefit from the role that money plays in politics obviously aren't going to like doing that. But those two things are absolutely important, absolutely fundamental. And if we have those, then several other things could and should follow. One is financial re-regulation, of course. Another, as I point out in the book, is real use of law enforcement to punish criminality in finance. And another is creating a really state-of-the-art internet infrastructure for the United States, which it doesn't currently have.
To make us competitive and to bring more millions of Americans into the economic mainstream.
Yes. Yes.
What's the key to this? You're sort of looking for a hero here, a leader who would come up and articulate this. Some people wanted to see that in President Obama. What in the chemistry of this country's politics are you hoping for as the sort of getting us on a path to change? You describe a wide boulevard that would take us to a really crummy direction. What about the other direction, the good direction?
Well, many times in American history, social and political movements have arisen when America has had problems. And I'm optimistic that that will happen again. We don't see much of it yet. Maybe Occupy Wall Street is a beginning of this. We'll see. But if you look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, in all of those cases and many others earlier in American history, the progressive movement at the turn of the last century, over a century ago, there have been many times in American history when America started to have a very serious problem and a lot of people in America banded together to fix it.
The Tea Party?
Not so far. Not so far. I don't see much recognition within the Tea Party of the importance of dealing with money in politics and financial re-regulation.
Oh, boy, what a picture. Charles Ferguson painted it vividly in The Inside Job and again in his new book, Predator Nation, Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. There's an excerpt at our website. You can read there, onpointradio.org. Charles Ferguson joined us today from New York. Charles, thank you very much. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for the book.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.